Blog Talk Radio.
What difference if I hail from North or South, or from the East or West? My heart is filled with love for all of these. I only know I swell with pride and deep within my breast I thrill to see, O glory faint, the breeze.
Gazprom, I think it's the Russians'
a gas company. So these natural resources we need, and you know, oil runs the world. One of the reasons that there's so many problems in that region of the world, Iran, the Gulf states, is because after World War, or just before World War One, excuse me, Jackie Fisher, Admiral Sir John Fisher, whom I admire, the founder of the modern battleship called Dreadnoughts, British realized that the Royal Navy, near 1,000 ships, had to switch from coal to oil. Where was the oil? In the Gulf states, Arabia, what was known as Persia. There was even oil, they've known this for a long time, in what was the old Soviet, the Russia, which was Imperial Russia under the Tsar's rule. And there's an excellent TV series on this, Riley, Ace of Spies. Riley was actually half Jewish. His mother was Jewish. His father was even illegitimate. He was a Russian nobleman. And his name is Sidney Rosenberg, took his mother's name, and he went to work for MI5. Great TV series on this. It was a real-life spy, and working for MI5, which was British Intelligence Service. So I recommend you catch that on TV. And I think it's on DVD disc. But anyway, that's one of the big things. And then we've learned that Afghanistan has a lot of natural resources. But the problem is there's all this tribalism there. Nobody has ever conquered Afghanistan. And I've always said the best thing we can do is contain the bastards. Because Islam is more than a religion. It's a jihad for a lot of the militants, and it has been throughout history that Westerners are considered the infidel, and those who believe in this militant Islam will do anything they can to kill us. Excuse me. Despite the phony protestations of that imam in New York, and we have our own one out here in the West Coast, and we'll get into Mr. Khorasani in the next show or two. He was the guy that brought out John Walker Lynn, the teenager, who, according to Newsweek magazine, was homosexually seduced. That, you know, they don't want to deal with that in the media, that this kid, 15, 16-year-old kid, impressionable, dysfunctional family, had been had more ways than one. So, you know, those stories are going to come out. Just as there are stories are going to, the facts are going to come out on the Stephen Neri case. They're still trying to bury it, but they can't. It's like Banquo's ghost is going to come back and haunt people until there's justice, and the sooner the better. So let me play this clip from this movie, and it's very accurate about why the Russians were in Afghanistan. Where the heck is it? Here we go. Right, I'm going to play it right now.
A minimum of knowledge necessary to interact with the locals. You'll find in this pamphlet here. See it? But the most important thing for you to remember when you cross the border is that you will be inside of an Islamic state. Islam is not just another religion. It's an entirely different world with its own set of laws, an alternate view of life, and of death.
This may be a little too long. I'm going to cut it and then replay it. Okay, let's try it now again.
A minimum of knowledge necessary to interact with the locals. You'll find in this pamphlet here. See it? But the most important thing for you to remember when you cross the border is that you will be inside of an Islamic state. Islam is not just another religion. It's an entirely different world with its own set of laws, an alternate view of life, and of death. A true Muslim is not afraid to die in battle. And those who perish while fighting against the infidels, which is get a one-way ticket to heaven, where they will get everything they lack in this life. Water, bountiful heart, and big bosomed virtue. Boy. Relations with women in Islam is a separate conversation. The most sacred thing to a Muslim is his home, haram. This is where the word haram comes from. The second meaning of this word is not allowed or forbidden. Looking at Muslim women, haram. Anything with sexual relations, haram. It's haram to show a Muslim any obscene gesture, which all of you are used to. For that, you can get a bullet from a peaceful civilian. On the other hand, a Muslim will never defile his own home with blood. The moment you step foot in a village, you are considered to be a guest. Killing a guest, even if it's an infidel, haram. So remember, never forget this. As long as you are within a village, you are safe. But the moment you step beyond its boundaries, the same host who was giving you tea 5 minutes ago can shoot you in the back with no hesitation. Because killing an infidel is an heroic deed. Stairway to heaven. I'm telling you this for your own sake, soldier. So here it is. Afghanistan. It is a multinational state. With more than 20 ethnic groups living there. Tajiks, Turkmen, Uzbeks. Along the Pakistan border, you have the Pushtuns, and in the west, Khazars and other Mongolian tribes, who settled here after the Mongol invasion in the 13th century. The word Khazar means 1,000 in the Turkic languages. Soldier, is this not interesting to you?
Comrade Captain, does it make a difference who we kill?
In all of history, no one has ever managed to conquer Afghanistan.
And that is so true, and that the Americans and others, Brits who think that we're going to conquer Afghanistan, they better go back and review history. Even Brigadier Ingo, who spent 30 years in the subcontinent, in the interview, which we'll play in another, probably next week, we'll combine these two clips, that Americans need to know and need to learn that there are situations which we cannot conquer, but maybe we can control somewhat. And so we have to adjust our policy accordingly rather than shed our blood for these futile military expeditions. The British lost 4 wars up there, and the Russians lost the last one, the 10-year war, and they withdrew. And you can go to our Amicus Veritas, A-M-I-C-U-S, V-E-R-I-T-A-S, YouTube site for the video and audio clip of what you just heard. I have to mic it up a little higher next time. And they get into the Russian experience as captain, talking to these draftees who are about to go to Afghanistan. And it's part of this movie called Company 9. I highly recommend it. So go to our Amicus Veritas YouTube site. excuse me. Now, interestingly, today, September 10th, since we're on the topic of death, this is the date, 1977, in France. The last execution by the guillotine, using the guillotine, which was named after a French doctor named Guillotin, but somebody added the N to the last part of his name. This invention for France was created about the time of the French Revolution, just before the French Revolution by the last king, the last Bourbon, or one of the last Bourbon kings, Louis XVI. Ironically, the French used to use a horrible method of execution called breaking on the rack, and that was a condemned person. I don't know if any women were used, but were put on the rack after horrible, depending on if it was an attempted killing of the monarch. There was a horrible case where the guy was tortured, his hands were burned, his flesh was torn with hot pincers, lead was poured on his wounds, and he was put on this wheel, cartwheel, and four strong horses were supposed to pull him apart. And of course there were a large crowd of witnesses to see this horrible torture, and it goes back to ancient Rome where it's not enough to punish someone, you've got to make them suffer. That's where we get these modern hate crime laws, or what I call the Caligula laws. But anyway, there's a myth, a mistake that the guillotine or killing of this blade was invented in France. According to some sources, the Irish were the first ones to invent this back in the 13th century. If you want to get an idea how the guillotine worked, those of you who have seen Papillon, which was, there's a lot of fiction involved in that film with Steve McQueen and a couple others. Papillon was a guy who was, what happens when in France, when a criminal, there was no way to rehabilitate him, or he was not rehabilitatable, and with the one exception of the Alfred Dreyfus case, they were shipped to French Guiana. And once they served their time up there, they were never allowed back in France. They lived their life there. And there are some of these people still living in French Guiana. They're pretty far gone. Papillon was based on a French criminal who was shipped there, and he was supposed to be the one. Papillon in French means butterfly. He was the one who supposedly escaped. There's a lot of mythology along that surrounds that case. And the guy who was shipped over with him was a guy who counterfeited French bonds during the 30s, a lot of financial disruption in France at that time. There is an execution there. If you attacked a guard when you were shipped to French Guiana, there was an automatic execution, and everybody witnessed this, and then the execution was done with the guillotine. So there's a scene in that movie Papillon in the early part of the film where someone is executed with by the guillotine. And it was supposed to be a humane way to kill people, very quick with the blade. But in 1977, there was the last execution by the guillotine in France, and it involved a Tunisian immigrant who had lost his leg in an industrial accident. And while he was in the hospital, he got involved with this young nurse or nurse's aide, and he allegedly forced her into prostitution, and when she objected and went to the police, or threatened to, he tortured her horribly and then strangled her to death and then threatened two other girls. This was in the poor city of Marseille, where a lot of the North Africans, immigrants and migrants came into France, and it's a very, it's an interesting place to be, let's put it that way. Anyway, he was condemned. Ironically, his lawyer, this happens not only in the American justice system, but this happens around the world. His lawyer was a far rightist, probably assigned to defend him, and the far right in France is anti-immigrant, anti-Arab, anti-Semitic, very reactionary, usually Catholic, anti a lot of things, anti-clerical. This lawyer apparently didn't do anything to defend him, and I guess Hamid Doujabi was indefensible, or his case was, and so he was the last person at age, he was 31 years old, to be executed on this date in 1977. There in France, under the next president, Mitterrand, who interestingly was here, I saw him here in San Francisco when he came to visit. He abolished capital punishment in France, and so it's life imprisonment in French prisons, and there are no place that you want to be. These French prisons are pretty bad, from what I'm told. So that happened today in history. And then some interesting, and then, of course, we thought that King Kong, the famous movie of the great ape, was going to kill Faye Ray. Well, she was born today in 1907. She was Canadian, and she was the woman who was in the grip of King Kong, and I guess the animal instinct and paternal instinct there prevented him from squashing her to death. And then Edmund O'Brien, here's a guy who never lost his New York accent, starred in a lot of films, and, of course, the most amusing was he was in the original Julius Caesar film with Marlon Brando, who played Mark Anthony. He's got that famous nose. He played Caesar. Sir John Gielgud played Casca. And then the guy who played in another New York film, Archie Bunker, he was in that film as a senator. All these guys with these strange accents. And then, Calhoun. Not Calhoun, but Big Nose. And he looked like Caesar with this great aquiline nose. He played Julius Caesar. And Calpurnia was Greer Garson. She played his wife. And Mark Anthony, and then James Mason, another English actor, played Brutus. Great film, black and white, and then the young Marlon Brando played Mark Anthony. So that's the film you ought to see. It was made in 1915. It was one of Marlon Brando's first films. That's when he was thin. And then Edmund O'Brien, it's just kind of funny to hear his New York accent. And he was born today, and then On the Road with CBS, this is Charles Carroll. He was born today in 1934. And then when we think of baseball and the so-called doping scandals, Roger Maris was born today. And then the great blind Puerto Rican New York musician, Jose Feliciano, he was born today. And among the deaths, those of you who remember the Cisco Kid, we had Leo Carrillo. He died in 1961. And then, of course, Hamedi Doujabaï, the Tunisian, was executed today. And then the great French singer, leftist, the husband of Simone Signoret, a great bosomy French actress, one of my favorite, Yves Montand, he died today. Great actor, great singer, great voice, and typically French. And not much more, no really great events today that happened on the 10th, probably some next week. Excuse me. So what I would recommend to people, also, now we just heard, and this needs to be clarified, that this federal judge in the Northern District of, not the Northern District, but the Central District of the Federal Judiciary of the Ninth Federal Circuit. There are three districts in California. There's the Northern, which is up here in San Francisco. There's the Central, which is Los Angeles, San Diego, and there's Eastern, which is Sacramento. Well, this judge, Phillips, Virginia Phillips, she's about 57 years old, and this is, I keep bringing this up to people, that when I worked in the legal field, one of the things I had to do was we had to check out the opposition and who would be the judge. And this, as I tell people, that the judiciary is probably the least scrutinized, the least known area in American life, yet they have increasingly great influence over everybody's lives, or they try to. And you need to know, I keep telling people, you never know whether you're going to be facing one of these people in a probate case, a criminal case, a civil case. You never know. So you got to know who's going to be passing judgment on your issues, or who's going to be passing judgment on you. Well, anyway, Virginia Phillips, she is in the River Central District of California, a young judge comparatively, appointed by Clinton. She's the one that came down with this decision that don't know, don't tell is unconstitutional. Now, here's the rule on a federal district judges and even a federal appellate court decision. That decision, as I understand it, and I don't think it's changed, stands only in that district. Now, unless the appellate court, which would be Ninth Circuit Appellate Court, hears her case, here's the case she decided, because she's beneath the appellate judges, and they uphold her decision, then that applies to the entire district. Now, her decision that don't ask, don't tell is unconstitutional only applies in the Ninth Circuit. Now, there until it's appealed to the appellate court or to the U.S. Supreme Court, which it will eventually go to for a lot of reasons, because the military is a separate and distinct constituency, an element in American society, and only Congress under the Constitution can write the rules. And they wrote the rule that, and the president approved it, that open homosexuality and lesbianism is banned in the military, even though there are gays and lesbians who've kept their mouths shut, their sleeves down, and their zippers and their underwear and their up and their pants closed. They do their job, they serve honorably, and they go on to get their veterans benefits and go on with their lives. They don't politicize their sexual preference, which is what the whole issue is about. Anyway, Judge Phillips' decision, unless another judge in the same district, Ninth Circuit, say in the Northern District or the Eastern District, comes down with a decision that's the opposite of Virginia Phillips' decision, then there's a conflict. Now, in the other circuits, we've got, 12 federal circuits. A judge in any other circuit is not obliged to honor Judge Phillips' decision. Current decision came down yesterday. So what happens when there's this, and now the whole purpose of the U.S. Supreme Court, one of the reasons is they're supposed to keep order among the districts. So they're supposed to resolve these type of conflicts. And then the Supreme Court is the final arbiter of these conflicts. And only the U.S. Supreme Court can overrule itself, except in San Francisco when they said in the Steve Nery case that those federal judges know where to stick their gavel. Well, their gavel will come down on them eventually. But anyway, that's the whole purpose of the federal judiciary, and the U.S. Supreme Court will probably have, during the 70s, during the Vietnam War, there were a lot of these military jurisdiction and habeas corpus cases that came up before the courts, especially here in the Ninth Circuit, because there were a lot of military bases here. So that's where Judge Phillips' decision stands right now. Now, there are there's some older cases which I came across in the Steve Nery case research that rule, I think it's the Sixth Circuit, Kansas, on this business of jurisdiction over the federal military. So this is going to be very interesting. We're going to probably see another judge in another district either issuing a decision contradicts Phillips' decision, but again, I predict this will go to the U.S. Supreme Court, like the gay marriage, gay lesbian marriage issue. Excuse me. Now, I keep telling people you need to look, research these judges, or have your lawyer do it. And he's going to charge you. But it's very interesting because within the legal profession, lawyers and clerks and everybody else, even the media that covers, are told you need to research the background of these people to know about them. Now, there are questionnaires that go out, and here's one on this Judge Phillips. Very interesting. Intelligence and knowledge. One attorney interviewed about Judge Phillips called her flat-out brilliant, a really smart person. Every place she's been in her career, now she's only 57, she's knocked the socks off of people with their competence. Another said she's very knowledgeable, very smart. A third attorney said she's very knowledgeable. While I disagreed with her analysis on some motions, she's well-versed as a judge. She spent a number of years as a court commissioner before she became a federal magistrate and a judge. So she's well-versed in a lot of areas of the law and procedure. Other interviewers, however, offered qualified praise. She's not the best judge, but she's certainly honest to try to get the right rulings. I would say she's fine with the law, but not outstanding. So her proclivities. The history is that she's impressed both sides of the political aisle, said one attorney, recalling Judge Phillips' record of being appointed to the bench. She's appointed to the bench in the Clinton administration. She has a record as a commissioner, then a judge in the state court and a magistrate, and then a district judge in the federal court. Her ability to bridge divides also affected in court, and another lawyer who noted that she's very well liked by lawyers on both sides, as far as I can tell. Several criminal defense and plaintiff's attorneys said she has proven to be more conservative than expected. She will listen to you, and if you do good work, most of the time she makes the right ruling. But she can trend toward the conservative side. I've heard negative things about her from other civil rights attorneys, but I think she's willing to give us rulings, like a lot of the Clinton judges. She's certainly not really over-the-top liberal. She can be a little conservative, but I think she's fair. Another said she's fairly even-handed, but as a plaintiff's lawyer, I find she's a bit conservative, but probably no more so than the average U.S. district judge. Another attorney more so asserted that she can be sensitive to the special circumstances of some criminal defendants, recalling a child pornography defendant as a case in point. She really understood what was going on with my client, that he needed help. She pushed the government. She really pushed the government. She was really terrific about it. She understood the nature of my client and the nature of his offense. She was really smart about it. Few attorneys interviewed about Judge Phillips were effusive in their praise, but most agreed that she is even-tempered, smart, and well-prepared. The most common gripe came from plaintiff's attorneys and criminal defense attorneys that she's more conservative than other Clinton appointees. So all these lawyers who appear before the judges, if they're willing to, they usually keep don't identify themselves, they do give assessments of the judges that they appear before or have cases before. But this is not well publicized, and you have to go dig this stuff up. And this is what I had to do when I worked as a researcher and investigator doing special work for law firms and judges. So that we'll put up on the website, because people need to know these things. Or, you know, who these people are who make these decisions that affect everybody's lives. Here's another evaluation, because this was a national case. Lawyers describe Phillips as a capable jurist. Her level of ability is good. This is from another evaluation series. She has a lot of common sense. Her scholarship is not always as strong as it should be. She's innovative sometimes. She is a good judge in a district with a lot of stars. Her level of ability is fine. She certainly has a good background before being promoted to a federal judgeship. Not all judges have this, I can tell you, having worked in the federal courthouse. She's a good judge to have on the vast majority of cases. She's a competent jurist. Her level of ability is okay. Lawyers gave Phillips high marks for her demeanor. She is delightful. She's very pleasant to appear before. She treats lawyers with a great deal of respect. She's very pleasant in her interaction with lawyers. She is polite, pleasant. She will never try to embarrass you in front of your client. She's a real delight. I've never seen her curt to lawyers. There are judges like that, for whatever reason. They may have a bad night, a bad day, or they're just cranky. And the longer some of these people appear on the bench, the longer, the worse they get. Some should never even be, should be in front of a judge and not sitting on a judge's dais with a judge's mallet, passing judgment on people below them. She's not as quirky in the least. She's poised and calm. She has fine temperament. She is level-headed. Lawyers describe Phillips' courtroom as well-managed. She runs a good operation. She likes to keep things moving. She can be particular about adherence to her rules. She is surprisingly formal. Now, there's a thing called rules of court, and they vary depending on the district, and that's an option of each district. They have certain rules that they arrive at, and there's sometimes there's good reason for this because of the particular nature of the district. Let's see, here's more on her. She is a stickler for procedural requirements. And that's the thing, whether you can't afford a lawyer and you're doing your own, what they call pro se work, the thing that if a judge wants to screw you, they'll find a procedural way to do it. So you've got to follow the rules. This is a warning to people who can't afford a lawyer but are not going to lay over and take it in the shorts, that if you're going to do a pro se thing, do it by following the procedures and the rules of court, and they're laid out for people who are non-lawyers, didn't go to law school, but have access to a law library and are literate and can write and know what to do to try to protect themselves, which is their right. She's very deliberative. She prefers form over substance. She will consider everything. She's very thorough. She reviews everything and requires lawyers to adhere to her rules. She is decisive. She gets her opinions out pretty quickly. Some judges are very slow about this. And, you know, considering their workload, some of these judges rely almost exclusively on their law clerks, and those are the people, the gatekeepers, who have a lot of influence over judges who don't really supervise their help. And this is a problem because we don't know, the public doesn't know who a lot of these clerks and staff attorneys and courtroom assistants are. And we should know because you're paying their salary. She is not generally involved in settlement, the lawyers interviewed said. She lets others handle it. Plaintiff attorneys said that Phillips is even-handed. I'd say she's pretty even. She is not a bleeding-heart liberal. She will not show any signs of bias. Well, there are judges that are, and we've seen this in the Stephen Neri case, the U.S. Navy sailor, and we'll get into that. She is neutral, which a judge should be. She does not seem to be partial toward either side. She treats both sides with fairness. She doesn't favor anyone. Well, I'm going to bring up a case, the Rose D'Aquino Taguri case, which I had to research when I was working in civil liberties. And her pardon came up, and I later met her after the pardon. I met her back east, and I did some work for the Japanese American, some volunteer work for the Japanese American community. And I always suspected something was wrong with this case, and the judge in the case, ironically, was born in Ireland, a guy named Michael Roach. He worked in what is known as the corrupt San Francisco District Attorney's Office, was a local judge there, it's more corruption, and then became appointed by FDR to the federal judgeship here in the Northern District. And he was the chief judge at the time that Rose Ivo D'Aquino was illegally tried here in San Francisco. And the word is, I was too young to attend the trial, but he was very biased and very pro-prosecution, which no judge should be. It's supposed to be neutral and fair and balanced. I hate to use that phrase, but that's accurate. Well, anyway, here's some more of her. Civil defense lawyers found Phillips to be fair. She is absolutely impartial. She is fair-minded. She treats both sides fairly. She keeps an open mind. She applies the law appropriately to the facts of the case. Well, a lot of judges, a growing number of them, don't. They can apply their biases. And we'll get into that another day. Let's see. She does a good job. She is tough when she has to be. She'll hold both sides accountable. She doesn't just accept what the government proposes. And that's the problem with former prosecutors who become judges. They, unless they're very careful and change their ways and their habits, they tend to be pro-prosecution. Phillips is fair at sentencing. Defense lawyer said she is quite fair-minded on sentences. She'll sentence at the low end of the guidelines when it is appropriate. There are federal guidelines, which are statute, which federal judges are supposed to follow on all types of cases, especially drug cases. And she has a heart on sentencing. She is okay when it comes to sentencing. She is fairly reasonable at sentencing. That's unusual with some of these judges. So this is what I've just given you is what lawyers who are surveyed after appearing before this Judge Phillips. Now, I'll disagree about her decision because it's going to have to be resolved by the federal courts and Congress. And, of course, the Defense Department, because as Chief Justice Earl Warren wrote, that the military is separate and distinct. And we have a whole set of rules, and American taxpayers spending millions of dollars to support a military judicial system. That does not mean that a soldier, sailor, airman is not accountable to the local civil authority, but their rights have to be protected, and that's why there's a universal code of military justice. There are special regulations to protect them from local prejudice. That didn't, Steve Neri didn't have that in his case 10 years ago. And there's some other cases that I've come across. A woman, Air Force case up in Solano County. We'll get into that one. So there's a lot there. There's a lot of money spent, and I understand there may be up to maybe over 5,000 federal military in local jails and prisons. And, of course, we had the notorious case, which was featured on 48 Hours on CBS, of Tim Matthews, Masters, excuse me, an 18-year-old kid, a Navy sailor, who was falsely accused of murdering and raping this woman, and the prosecutors in that case rigged the case. They later became Colorado state judges, and instead of removing these people and stripping them of their bar card and even prosecuting them, they just got reprimanded. I mean, this kid, they railroaded in the Colorado State Prison for nearly 16 years. And the same thing happened to Steve Neary here, and it's a much worse case, but we have much more documentation showing the corruption in the case and what happened to him and how the media morons lied and accused him of having a gay tryst with a guy he never even met before. And the word tryst means that a meeting between two lovers, and two people who previously knew each other. Steve Neary didn't know this Juan P. Frey, but we'll get into more of that because it's starting to come out, and it's appropriate because his case, has cost the American taxpayer an estimated $15 million, and the costs are still climbing. But American military personnel have been railroaded, especially in the South, if they were servicemen who were black or Jewish or even Catholic, or Northerners, if they ran afoul of local authority down there, those rednecks would do everything they could to make that guy's life miserable and to railroad him into a chain gang or state prison. Things were so bad at Fort Benning, Georgia, which was across the river from Phoenix City, Alabama, which Time magazine labeled the most corrupt city in America. Now it's San Francisco. But anyway, when General Patton was the commandant at Fort Benning, the soldiers used to cross the river and go to the dives and bars in Phoenix City, and they were rolled for money, watered-down drinks, and they'd get into fights and all that. And the local police and sheriff would arrest them and throw them into the hoosegow. And Patton got so angry because he knew that his soldiers were being railroaded. And he said, he got tired of it one day and said, if you don't release my soldiers right away, I'm sending tanks across the bridge and we'll blow your town to hell. So that's what we need today, especially in a city like San Francisco, where if you, a straight male gets into a conflict, with a alleged homosexual or a lesbian, if it goes to the criminal courts, the person is likely to be railroaded, or the jury will be, if there's a jury trial, they'll be solicited, which happened in the Steve Neary case. So I wanted to bring that up on Judge Phillips because people need to know these things. And, of course, the media doesn't. Most of the media that does write on the Don't Ask, Don't Tell are pro-homosexual, pro-lesbian, and pro-NAMBLA, and pro-illegal alien. And so they're not going to report this case fairly and accurately. And of course, they're not held accountable because if a media person lies, unless his editor fires him or her, there's no accountability. That's one of the reasons why people don't buy newspapers anymore. They don't trust the printed and even the electronic press because he knows these people have lied, distorted, and omitted, and will continue to do so as long as they can get away with it. excuse me, I'm losing my voice there for an hour. And somebody asked me to play replay one of the other interviews because they're concerned about the sharks appearing in areas where there were no sharks. So I'm going to play this great white shark interview of the Australians, first guy to survive a great white shark.
Paul and I'm previewing the film The Great White Shark. Shark is a pejorative term to most people, and unlike wolf, the shark really does get into your hide. I'm speaking to Peter Thompson from South Australia, who is an experienced abalone man. Welcome to the program, Peter.
Hello. How are you, Paul?
Peter, what are your observations on sharks and fishermen?
Well, it's pretty hard to say until you've actually been in the water with them.
Have you?
Yes, I've been. I was a professional abalone diver myself for about 7 years, and I personally come across them freed in the wild on two occasions, within swimming close to me 2 or 3 feet away. But it wasn't until we made this film that I was able to observe them from the protection of a cage, and it was still quite scary.
Even you were down there among the lions and the jackals, as you said in your film, huh?
Yes, you can say that again. But no, they're quite big, and you really don't know what they're going to do, and I don't think they even know what they're going to do themselves.
What are your reactions on, what are your impressions? Do sharks, do divers telegraph their presence, or do they give off an odor, or what?
No, I think they just come across you on the bottom, and it's my belief that that they see you a long time before you see them, and from
is their eyesight that good?
I don't think it's so much the eyesight. I think they can detect you.
But how?
Well, I'm not an experienced scientist, but I believe some sort of sonar or something equivalent to that.
Of course, sound travels very quickly in water.
Oh, yes, as you'll see by that film, you just tap something like metal under the water and you can hear it a very long way. And I think that they can hear you taking abalone off the rocks or similar sounds, especially with the noise of the cage may attract them also. But nearly all the abalone divers in South Australia, well, on the west coast of South Australia at the moment, there's 23 licensed divers, and if they don't all own one, nearly all of them own a cage, but there's only about 17 or 18 of them actually using them at the moment.
So the other five are at risk.
Yes, well, you can sort of collect more abalone without the cage. It's sort of a bit of...
You might live longer too.
Yes, that's for sure. But you can collect more abalone without the cage, but you take the risk.
You're in the business, Peter. Right here in California, we're having a fight with between the abalone fishermen and the people who like the sea lions and the sea otters. Do you think that environmentalists tend to get astigmatic, that they don't really see that these things have got to be kept in balance, otherwise we're going to have a preponderance of predators like the sharks?
Oh, I think nature takes its course.
Should people interfere?
No, I think that everything should just sort of take its own course, you know, with nature. And that...
Of course, if nature took its course, there'd be more divers end up in the belly of the shark.
Well, there's only been quite a few, really, shark attacks, and people have died. There's a lot more get killed on the freeways.
Of course, there are no sharks behind the wheel. You guys driving the wrong side of the road. But do you think that the environmentalists ought to look at, there is a balance in nature just as there is a balance in maintaining your car or other things in life?
Yes, I think that it can be evenly balanced with the nature here in South Australia or in Australia. Seals and dolphins and porpoises and all those mammals, they're all protected, and nobody really worries them. And there's not much trouble in that particular side of nature.
Well, now that the people are using the metal cages, are they maintaining their lifestyle? I mean, are they able to harvest enough abalone to... is it safer to harvest abalone is what I'm saying.
Oh, yes. It's quite safe to harvest abalone. Their incomes are brought back a bit because of the cages aren't...
slower but safer.
They're slower but safer, yes.
We've been speaking to Peter Thompson, who is an abalone fisherman. Thanks for being on the program, Peter, and welcome to San Francisco.
Yeah, thanks, Paul.
Okay. This is Peter Paul for Animals and the Idea of the Great White Shark. You don't want to meet him. He's not a practical pet. Thanks for listening.
Now, since we have a little more time, I hadn't planned this, but Visitor Engel, when he... was in Afghanistan and Pakistan. He was a great horseman, and he talks about. We asked him about the Afghan hound and other dogs up there. So we'll play a clip from that interview.
Did you see any Afghans or any type of unusual, you know, the Afghan hound dogs in Pakistan when you were up there?
Yes. When I was in what was then British India, now Pakistan, I had a lot of greyhounds, long dogs, and I had some Australian terriers that went with them. And one of my great friends was Sir Umar Hayat Khan Tiwana. He was the head of the Tiwana Qaum tribe, and he lived in sort of feudal splendor in a village called Kalra. And I used to go and stay with him, and we used to take these long dogs out and run against hares and that sort of thing. And as well, Sir Umar had a big covey, or whatever you call them, of hawks. Mm-hmm. And we used to fly these hawks against greater bustard and pigeons and all sorts of things. It was a great experience. And the old gentleman was a very charming host. Alas, he's long gone. But the Tiwanas were famous horsemen in the Salt Range area.
Thank you, General Ingalls, for being on the program. As we say, old soldiers never die, and you certainly still have a lot of life in you.
Well, thank you very much, but they say we fade away.
Yes, the old general is dead. He had a splendid funeral, which I couldn't go to here in San Francisco. It's something that differs, the difference between the survivors of military personnel in Britain and as compared to the United States, that in Britain, when a military person dies who was on pension, his survivors do not continue to get his pension. Like the wife, she's on her own. It's cut off. But here in the States, I understand that the survivors still get the pension and support from the military or from the government. So that's one of the little-known things. I didn't know that when the general died. Let's spend a little more time here. I hadn't planned on this. I want to play a little Will Rogers on government plans. It's still one of the funniest things you've ever heard. Here we go. Uh-oh, got a little problem here. I don't know what happened. But,
Made in this country, there is not who shall be relieved and whose money shall relieve him, but who shall be the one that plays Santa Claus and actually hands out the presents, you know? That's the main part from the day, is who hands out the presents. Here he says, he should wear the whiskers. And if you can let the Hopkins, they say no, we've got sleigh bells ourselves. Governor Talmadge, down in Georgia, he had a plan. It hit a rut and knocked him right out of the bread line last week. Now, it's been a bad week on plans all around. I'm not going to get discouraged, though. In fact, these other failures, well, they've given me confidence, you know. More hope that my plan will be a success. Now, my plan, to state it in a nutshell, and in fact, that's where all plans come from. And the nut should never be cracked. But here is my plan in a nutshell. My plan is a plan to end all plans. It's to do away with all plans. That's what it is. There ain't but one place that a plan is any good and that it'll really work, and that's on paper. But the minute you get it off a sheet of paper and get it out in the air and it blows away, that's what it is. Now, Mr. Roosevelt, he dragged more heat plume arms out of little red schoolhouses. And they
don't know what happened there, but this was done during the mid-30s. Will Rogers was a great humorist, Native American ancestry from Oklahoma. in August, 75 years ago, he died in a plane crash with, I think, Wiley Post and Newt Rockne. They're flying in Alaska. But he was a great political humorist. He wasn't the type that we see today who are nasty, snide, smarmy. You want to take him in an alley and talk to him with a baseball bat. Or what Al Capone used to do in Chicago was with media people. The mob would put a bar of soap in a sock and then beat a person that didn't leave marks on the victim. I'm not recommending that, but I'm just repeating what how media people were handled. But anyway, Will Rogers did quite a few tapes, and we have them in the archives. And I think what this last one, which you played a couple of times before, is very apropos because we keep hearing about these plans. And as Will Rogers noted back in the 30s, the Roosevelt administration, that a lot of these plans are just no good. They're only good on paper. And we keep hearing about new plans from Washington, and we see where the stimulus has gone. It didn't stimulate anything except more stimulus. So, even though these tapes are 75 years old, what Will Rogers and others said back then is still apropos to today, and even more so. And what I like about him is the humor, that he can do it. He did it in such a way without being snide, smarmy, smartass, like we see some of these talking heads today. So we're going to end with our favorite theme, and we'll be back Tuesday with some new things. And where is it? Here we go.
Hey, Ben, want a hand?
No, you guys go ahead. I got too much on my mind to play poker.
King bet.
Cost you five. Tony, up to you.
Hey, Tony, what are you
going to
do?
I'm in.
Oh, five.
Me too.
Gentlemen, here we are, and one thing is clear. We gotta pick a candidate for Congress this year.
Big ace.
Ace bet.
You'll pay through the nose.
Okay, where's the cash?
I'm in.
So am I.
Likewise.
Here goes.
Possible straight, possible flush. Nothing.
Gentlemen, how about some names we can use? Some qualified Republican who's willing to lose.
How's it going? We should make Jack Riley the guy.
Which Riley are you thinking of, Jack B or Jack Y?
I say neither one. I never even met him.
I say when you got a pair of jacks, bet out.
Politics and poker, shuffle up the cards and find the joker. See the game for children, see the game is rough. Decisions, like
put a pick
on a play, not a bet.
Where's the call of love?
All right now, fellas, politics or poker, which is more important?
Paratrade.
Bet 'em.
Little trade, good as gold.
I'll say.
Raise your mind.
I'll call.
I'll hold.
I'll raise your back.
I think you're bluffing.
Put your money where your mouth is.
Okay, I'm in.
Gentlemen, knock it off and let's get this done.
Try, Michael, when you think of it, I'm certain he'd run.
Mike is out. I'm afraid he just wouldn't sell. Nobody likes a candidate whose name they can't spell.
How about Dave Zimmerman?
Davey's too bright.
What about Walt Gustafson?
Walt died last night.
How about Frank Monahan?
What about George Gale?
Frank ain't a citizen and George is in jail.
We could run out Wallenstein.
He's only 23.
What about Ed Peterson?
You idiot! That's me!
Yep. You know, try to stack the deck this November unless the voters out there across the country are watching for vote fraud. Absentee voter fraud may be the new one, and then screwing the military veterans who are overseas. You can manipulate those ballots also. So we'll see you Tuesday. This is Peter Paul Vizzola. Thank you for tuning in. This can be downloaded on iPod, and also the archives are still up there. And go to our Amicus Veritas YouTube site, AmicusVeritas, and also our websites. And we're working now on a campaign to make bicyclists accountable to follow the rules of the roads and get these damn reckless drivers off the roads. If you're tired of paying higher insurance premiums, if you're a safe driver, take care. Mm-hmm. Okay.